CFO Radio is the only radio show that explores the passion of today's CFO and examines the innermost thoughts of the financial world, financial perspectives of tomorrow. Welcome to CFO Radio. I'm Lorraine Chilvers.
And we'd like to thank our sponsors, Delaney Consulting, LLC, providing financial leadership to fast-growing companies, interim management and executive placement for the finance function. Visit DelaneyLLC.com and learn why 100% of their clients describe Delaney's services as outstanding and excellent. Also, Financial Executives International, the preeminent association for CFOs and other financial executives. We are sponsored by the Atlanta chapter.
And this week's CFO Radio News is brought to us by CFO.com. Their recent article that is entitled, What Makes High Performers Stay? If talented finance staffers don't have strong managers, good pay is not at all likely to help you retain them. Says David McCam. High-performing finance staffers know what they like, money, their own and in addition to the company's. They're grumpy about not having more of it, but not so much that it makes them look for new jobs, as the article details. Those are among the conclusions that can be drawn from the latest research by the Finance and Strategy Practice of the Corporate Executive Board, CEB. Asked to rate 38 job attributes, 43% of the approximately 1,000 participating high performers judge compensation to be important, far outstanding work-life balance, and the number two response. That may be one reason why they are disappointed with the pay that they get. Reporting their level of satisfaction with the various job attributes, they ranked compensation near the bottom, in fact in 35th position out of the 38 job attributes. Topping the list were company location, stability, and product/service quality. Yet factoring in responses to questions designed to gauge finance employees' intentions about staying in their job versus leaving, the CEB found a surprisingly low correlation between satisfaction with compensation and an inclination to seek other employment. The statistical analysis showed manager quality, future career opportunity, and senior leadership reputation as the leading drivers of retention of employees, while compensation ranked no higher than 11th. Well, moving on from that financial employment-based news article, I would like to welcome to the radio show this morning Annabelle Malins. Annabelle is joining us. She is the British Vice Consul in Atlanta for today's show. Welcome to the show, Annabelle.
Good morning, Lorraine. Very lovely to be here.
Well, I must say, from a British perspective, it's great to have a leading British lady on the show. So thank you for that also.
It's a great pleasure.
Well, we're going to talk a lot about investment opportunities between the US and the United Kingdom today. But what I'd like to do, Annabelle, is let's start at the beginning. Let's give a little bit of background of who you are and how you've arrived at your current position. How did you get to be this position?
Well, I'm a bit of an odd diplomat. I actually am a science and had science and technology education as my starting point. And the first 20 years of my career were in the private sector. But I've always been a bit of a globetrotter. I love
like the travel.
Absolutely. And so during my time in the private sector, I've clocked up quite a lot of experience working in many countries in sub-Saharan Africa, long-term experience in the Caribbean, Latin America, India, and of course Europe. But about 12 years ago, I took the plunge and became a diplomat. And since then, in the Foreign Office, I've worked on a whole range of foreign affairs, which is very much the style that diplomats adopt. They sort of recycle themselves on a fairly regular basis. So I've covered a bit of all sorts, bilateral relations with Northeast Asia and Pacific countries, international organizations, global issues, including environment policy. And so quite a range of activities. It's one of the great stimulations of diplomatic life.
And but, you've traveled a lot during those times.
I have, yes, plenty of opportunities for travel. But I took up my first appointment in the United States back in 2005. I was covering collaboration in science and innovation and climate change and energy policy with the United States.
So that's wonderful. You were able to bring in your earlier career with your current diplomat role.
Yes, it's you know, perhaps not so well understood that diplomacy actually requires, you know, the full range of talents that might be represented elsewhere in society. So as a scientist, I'm a bit of a rare commodity, but it comes in pretty handy.
And you are today in Atlanta. What area do you cover? Because I understand there are others that carry and manage various regions around the world.
That's right. As Consul General here in Atlanta, and I arrived here in September 2009, I am responsible for British interests in the southeast of the United States. For me, that's a huge patch. It's six states. It covers North and South Carolina, Georgia, Tennessee, Alabama, and Mississippi. And,
but not Florida?
No, Florida has a consul general of its own, and so it should. There's lots going on there too. So as a nation, we have representation in each region, major region of the United States. In fact, we've got 10 offices in the United States. It's a big place.
It absolutely is. And as we say that, I may apologize. I think I introduced you as Vice Consul. I apologize. You are Consul General.
Absolutely.
So let's make sure for the record that I get that right. So that's your start. You've got a great strength in terms of business and the science side of the business house. Today, your role is to facilitate and create those opportunities between corporations. So I can imagine that it's been very helpful for you to be within those corporations as an executive to know how to meander. There's probably some awkward and hallways that you have to meander.
Well, that's true. I relish the business element of my job, but I do have some expert teams which support me in what I do. And so, for example, I've got a team that works on supporting science and innovation connections between the UK and this part of the country, and also specialists in trade and investment who can help me to get the right information across, because our main focus at the moment is to make sure that all the world are aware that Britain is open for business. And that's a whole team effort, because of course that starts with our education partnerships, our innovation partnerships, as well as the business-to-business type connections that my team is helping to make.
You know, you make a very interesting point. Having spanned a couple of countries in my time frame and having relocated for business, I understand too well that the job move part of it very often is one element that might trigger a move or trigger an investment. But at that point in time, the people that are making the investment in that other territory or other country or region of the world, if you don't have all the key elements of perhaps where they came from as a minimum, such as education, social economic elements of whatever else in your life comes with that, whether it's the arts, the theatre, all those different things, in order for your family to move, very often that investment can be shelved in a heartbeat, because if the family's not happy, the investor can't be happy.
I think that's a really interesting point. I mean, it's obviously a life-changing decision to move internationally. And, you want to have well-supported and happy executives leading your business. But in addition to that, I think, businesses that are looking internationally need to get a feel for what the political and economic context is of their operating environment. And so that's one of the areas that we can help too. We can explain what the business environment is like in the UK, and also get a little bit, offer information from what's behind the news in terms of the decisions that the government is taking, a bit more about the why and what the potential implications are on a broader level.
And obviously that might have implications in any economic investment that an investor would make, whether that investor is a private wealthy individual or a corporation or some kind of a institutional investor, I would imagine.
Yes.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the British Consulate General. What is the mission? And I don't know whether this question is targeted at Atlanta or a more broad scope. What is the mission?
Well, it is an interesting question, difficult to encapsulate. So I hope I don't ramble on too long. But, we are multifaceted, and obviously, often we're present where there are British nationals, either resident or travelling, and that includes for business reasons, but also, other cultural reasons.
So for holidays, vacations, fun, social.
That's right. So I have a team that provides support to British nationals, whether or not it's because they've lost their documents or they get into other more serious trouble. But we're there for them, and that's an important part of our function. In addition to that, it is actually covering these areas which are all part of the fabric of the very broad-ranging relationship between the United Kingdom and the United States. So we are wanting to make sure that contacts here understand modern Britain, know what we're about, you know, how we tick, and hopefully find us an attractive place to visit, not just on holiday, but also on business. And we're very pleased to, you know, spread the word.
And interestingly that you connect the holiday and the business, because very often I myself find that business executives will go to various different parts of the world and they go and they get on the plane and they come back. But very often for the United Kingdom and Great Britain at large, there are extra days added on. And I think we have a very attractive opportunity for that. And perhaps likewise, UK investors or business individuals coming over to the United States, very often there might be a trip to Orlando or something else, maybe a trip to San Francisco, depending on what the reason for their visit and where they're visiting.
That's right. I think another important sort of starting point for a lot of people is going on school exchanges. And we have a lot of schools and universities in the Southeast that do take summer schools into the UK. There's a very valuable link at UGA, University of Georgia, who have a long-running summer school at the University of Oxford. But that's just...
So do the students partake abroad for a semester or a term and then they come back to their student education in their first country?
Absolutely, yes, they do. And they gain credit points towards their studies whilst they're in the UK. But that's actually now a model that's being extended right through to the research level. And we have some universities that are partnering on PhDs, for example. But that's also reciprocated arrangements. I think we think that at any one time, there are probably 400 or 500 British students here in our region who are studying at schools.
That's fabulous. And let's face it, the world today is a small place. Mm-hmm. You know, the cottage industry of 30, 40, 50 years ago that might have been an individual, whether it's a, you know, mother, father, husband, wife, perhaps, let's say, making shoes on the street corner and selling it to the local friends and family. Today, that same person is on the internet and probably selling to Peru or Nicaragua.
Yes, I think it's really important for young people to get a feel for the wider world. It's so important. It really does impact on their everyday lives. So for them to get a real sense of it through travel is a terrific start in their lives.
Mm-hmm. So we've covered the basics of the mission of the Consulate General. Let's talk a little bit, if I'd like to, Annabel. We know that the UK, or at least I'm familiar with the UK, having a new coalition government that's been in place for about a year now, and many of our listeners may be familiar with this too. We've heard about what's called austerity measures. How are these panning out?
Well, the coalition government that was elected in May 2010 inherited an unprecedented fiscal challenge. We had at that time the largest peacetime deficit in our history. And there was very strong consensus actually across the parties that we needed to have healthy public finances in order to get back onto sustainable economic growth coming out of the recession. But this government was elected with a strong mandate to take urgent action to fix that problem. And they have done just that. They came straight in, setting out a pathway to reduce or actually eliminate our structural deficit by 2014-15, and last year announced the detailed plans on how they were going to deliver that. And with those plans are now, you know, biting. They've been very well endorsed by the IMF and the OECD, and generally the path that the UK is taking, it has been well respected internationally, and it is actually you know, starting to deliver some results. Of course, it has meant some really tough decisions. It means cutting public sector jobs. You know, we've also had issues around the civil service pensions, mm-hmm. And many other areas to refocus spending on areas for long-term growth. So at the same time as there are cutbacks, there's also investment in infrastructure, for example, including broadband, faster broadband, in other areas like low carbon investment and in science. And these are very carefully targeted to help promote private sector-led growth, which is the way the government sees our road to recovery.
And that is very much in terms of emerging technologies. We think of all those areas that you mentioned in terms of science, but today science cannot get on without being coupled so tightly with technology.
That's absolutely right. I think, you know, we have... both our countries, the United States and the UK, have the strongest research universities in the world. But that really has to get translated through the innovation process and, you know, to deliver economic results. And that's another close area of collaboration.
And I would imagine that these elements of what you're describing about the new coalition government speaks to a concentration of what an investor needs in terms of stability. An investor has to be a very high risk aptitude to be able to go into an unstable country.
That's right. And certainly in the UK, I think people respect us as being, you know, politically stable, that we've now got an economically sustainable plan, which is being closely followed. And it certainly is aimed at providing the certainty that business needs and able to make those brave decisions.
And just to put in a little bit of a personal element for the UK, not of mine, but we have certainly a new very famous married couple. Princess Kate, she's getting around now. They're making a trip to the US. Has that done some good for US-UK trade?
I'm sure it does. It's wonderful to have the UK so much in the spotlight. We all enjoyed the royal wedding at the end of April, and their tour first to Canada and just about to arrive in the United States is certainly attracting quite a media frenzy. And whilst they're in the United States, they certainly will be helping to promote British business.
That's fabulous. That's fabulous. Well, how has this new coalition government and the measures that they've been taking affected the business environment in the UK?
Well, the whole focus here for the government is about creating private sector growth. Well, of course, the government cannot tell business what to do, but they can focus policy on creating the conditions for growth. And so that's been a top priority for the government, and looking at areas where they can help to improve the business operating environment.
And is that purely financial, fiscal, economic, or are there broader elements? Is it related to interest rates, taxes and the like, or is it broader than that?
It certainly includes that, but it's actually a whole of government effort. Every single government department is aimed on this same objective. And there have been some exciting new measures, really good news for business that have been announced, and those are continuing to come through. One that's really caught a lot of people's eye is a reduction in the main rate of corporation tax. And in fact, we will by 2014 have the lowest rate of corporation tax in the G7 at 23%. But that is just one element. There are other structural reforms that are underway, and that covers a whole host of areas, from planning, from competition rules, through to intellectual property, access to finance, skills development. It really is a sort of root and branch effort in all areas to help support private sector growth. And of course, removing the red tape, you know, barriers. And that's been another important focus.
You know, it's interesting that you say that. Very often my company is involved in either the establishment of corporations for purposes of growth. Very often people look to creating an investment opportunity in a new country or a new region. And the first instance of how do you do that, the legal structure of how you can do that, whether it's through a new legal entity that would be classified as a quote-unquote foreign entity or an alien entity, depending on the country. Some countries you have to do it by joint venture. For example, China, it's virtually impossible as a Western country to open up a company without having that joint venture owned. Having said that, a lot of companies are also looking to publicly traded opportunities for their shareholders through time. And the London Stock Exchange, certainly abroad, is known as being very efficient and effective and have less of that red tape, if you will, that you're describing. And so I think with the stability of London being known as a very strong financial market, I think that Lloyd's of London has done a tremendous amount of good over the decades, if not millennia, for that. But the London Stock Exchange is going strong.
Mm-hmm. That's true. And, you know, the City of London certainly is a very efficient establishment as a whole, very well respected internationally. And it creates a very strong underpinning for companies that are wanting to do business in the UK, but not just the UK. I think it also provides something of a springboard for the globe, and particularly for European markets, but for other countries too.
I find that a lot of US-based companies, when they want to have a starting point in Europe, they often look to either Great Britain or Ireland because of the very ease of which the language is not a preventative, it's an aid. Although having done the move, I sometimes think UK and US, we speak different languages.
Yes, but two great nations divided by a common language.
That's
as
right, that's
said.
Right. Well, what about UK trade and investment? Tell us a little bit more about perhaps what is there, what opportunities exist?
I'd love to. It's in our blood in Britain to be, you know, a trading nation. And, you know, I was quite surprised to learn myself that one in four UK jobs is actually linked to business overseas. It's quite a stunning figure. And we are independently ranked as the easiest place in Europe to set up and run a business. That's in the World Bank rankings. We have a very flexible labour market, and I think that's one of the factors you're probably alluding to in terms of the sorts of challenges or considerations that companies might have when they're looking internationally.
And it's a very well-educated employment labour force, as well as not only educated from a scientific or technological perspective, but also from a language. Very often here in the US, you find that the professional people may perhaps not have spoken a second or third or fourth language, but in Europe, it's quite common to speak two, three or four languages.
That's true. And certainly in London, you'll hear probably most of the languages of the world being spoken, and the City of London also represents that. But yes, we are a very internationalized country. We're multicultural. You know, we have people with roots in many different parts of the world who live and, you know, have lived for multiple generations in the UK. And I think that diversity is a real strength for the business sector. But you also mentioned, you know, sort of education. And I think, you know, that goes back to what we discussed a little bit earlier on the research side and our entrepreneurship. And that's something that we really cherish. In fact, the OECD ranks the UK as having the least number of barriers to entrepreneurship in the world. And that's really important to us. And it promotes innovation in the UK, but also it makes it attractive for companies from other countries that are looking for a place to operate.
And if you add onto that the reduction in corporate tax rates, that's almost the cherry on top of the cake.
I'd like to think so. And you know, the another sort of factoid which I think tends to surprise people is that the UK is the sixth largest exporter globally. We're also the third largest investor in foreign markets. So, as I mentioned, this really is in our blood. It's you know, part of being in the UK. And the other I think misnomer about the UK is that we're not just a service economy. We're actually ranked as the world's ninth largest manufacturer. So there's a lot going on, and you know, I'm very pleased to tell people more about it.
Well, let's talk perhaps just briefly about that manufacturing, because I think you're right. We tend to think of the UK, London Stock Exchange, Lloyd's of London, insurance, financial services, professional firms, and the word consulting gets thrown in that mix. And because of the educational base that the UK has had for decades, if not centuries, I think that's created those opportunities. But let's talk a little bit about the aspects of what helps within that cause. Do you think that there are additional elements that from the US we could perhaps become more aware of?
Well, certainly, you know, I think it's good for people to know that, you know, our innovation didn't stop with the steam engine or the telephone or penicillin, you know, but it was British minds that designed the iPod and Viagra.
Wow.
So, you know, we're still contributing.
There you go.
To the world at large.
To the world at large. There you go.
But we also, you know, have real strengths in, as you mentioned, in manufacturing, and that's in advanced manufacturing and biopharmaceuticals. We're a big automotive. We have a large automotive sector, which is still expanding, which is exporting. We're the second largest aerospace and defense sector in the world. That's just behind the United States, certainly by jobs. And so that there are sectors which actually match quite well onto some of the areas that are particularly strong here in the United States too.
Goodness, I actually hadn't realized a lot of that myself. Well, interesting. So what is the relationship between the UK and the US in terms of FDI?
Some pretty impressive stuff, actually. We're each other's single largest foreign investor. And UK investment stock in the United States is 18.5% of total foreign investment in the United States. So some pretty big numbers. And that's nearly 140 times China's investment in the United States.
Wow, that blows my mind.
Yes. So this is a pretty big relationship, and it's certainly, you know, it is reciprocated. So UK investment here in the United States accounts for a million jobs in the United States, and these are jobs that are high value. Their average salary would be as much as 30% greater than the average US salary.
So these are professional
jobs.
People, highly educated individuals.
Yes, absolutely. And of course, we benefit in a similar way from US investment in the UK. US investment represents about 13%, or US investment in the UK represents about 13% of the United States investment abroad. And that's nearly nine times the United States investment stock in China.
Wow.
So again,
both directions.
Yes, absolutely. And we you know, benefit almost the same extent in jobs from US investment. So our relationship with the United States is obviously very important. Of course, financial services, which you've mentioned, are quite a big portion of that US investment in the UK, something like a third, but not much less than a third is actually investment in manufacturing in the UK. So it's a well-balanced and broad array of, you know, partnership and economic relationship. And this is not just based on our historical links. Over a quarter of new investment projects in the UK last year were from the United States.
So this is new emerging opportunities.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Goodness. And that tends to come from the educational field, and it tends to come from entrepreneurial avenues. And with you having described the UK being such a strong entrepreneurial marketplace, that it's almost that the pot is just bubbling.
I think it's right. I mean, we are a big market in our own right as a nation. You know, we're one of the big economies of the world. I think it is that the value that we attach to entrepreneurship and the attractiveness that we have for those innovative companies that perhaps continues to drive a lot of that continued exchange.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the trade and investment benefits to the US. If you could expand a little bit about that.
Well, certainly. Probably self-evident would be that the UK is actually quite a big export destination for the United States. And that's, as I mentioned, you know, we're a large market in our own right. And we're also the United States' top partner for trade in services. We're both very strong in that area. And of course, we continue to be each other's most productive partners in science. And that's, we've talked a little bit earlier about how important that is to driving the whole business activity. Mm. We, each of us, have very strong research universities, and we, between us, account for 50% of all Nobel Prizes.
Really?
Yes. So I think we can give ourselves a pat on the back for that.
Wow.
But in 2010, UK investors invested about $800 million into US innovative companies, and about $1.1 billion was invested by US investors in innovative UK companies.
That's huge.
Mm-hmm. It is. And so we are each helping to drive each other's future business and, you know, growth in the most exciting areas.
Is that small one-off companies, or is it the large conglomerates that have a global feel, or is it a combination of different sizes?
I'd say it's certainly a combination. The big guys have most definitely spotted this is a positive attribute in the UK, and the major Fortune 500 companies have major investments in the UK, and particularly using us as a ground for some of their R&D work. These companies range from Hewlett Packard through to Coca-Cola. So that also accounts for some of the smaller companies who, you know, find the UK an easy operating environment. So,
and obviously with the US-UK transportation and being so easy, London is a hub for a lot of international, certainly flights, certainly once you're in Europe, once you're in the UK, trains, planes and automobiles, you can pretty much get anywhere.
Yes, that's right. And I think, you know, this is just a whole good news story. We've lots of mutual benefits all around. And we see that these type of links in trade and investment are good for everybody. You know, for consumers, they get the benefit of more competitive prices. They get more innovative products. They've got more choice. And it makes their household budgets go further. And manufacturers benefit because, you know, they can access global supply chains and keep their own product costs as competitive as possible, you know, help them to continue to be successful. And that competition promotes productivity and efficient allocation of resources. And there's good data to back up the fact that companies that are invested internationally or doing business internationally are more productive than their neighbours or others in the sector. And it's also good for jobs, of course, because, you know, more exports, more productivity means that companies can grow and provide, you know, more jobs for workers.
And particularly if you're in an area of flexible employment, you can curtail and expand. And the ability to do so is very, very good. And certainly one of the elements that I have experienced in the UK versus perhaps Europe at large is that some of the other European countries, just on a worldwide basis, are known as being easier or more difficult from a perspective of employment, from unions, from labour disputes and so forth. And the UK's got a pretty good record on that.
Yes, I think that is a really big selling factor for us. We are sort of acknowledged to have one of the most flexible labour markets in the world. And that's important because the global marketplace is it's changing every day. And, you know, companies need to be able to respond to that in terms of both their processes and also, you know, their product ranges. So, you know, we respect that need for flexibility.
Well, let's talk about some of the challenges. What barriers do you face? Maybe what I would describe as protectionist ideologies play into US-UK trade relations at all?
Well, I've talked a little bit about why trade and investment is a good thing for sure. Everybody, but it's probably much easier to see why inward investment in the United States is benefiting the US than it is perhaps to understand that investment overseas for the United States is also a good thing for all the reasons that I've mentioned. So what is a bit disappointing is that one tends to see discussions around Buy America, and that pops up at all levels, local government, state government and federal government. And that's something I think we really do need to guard against because, you know, the facts just don't back it up. I don't think it really is good for the United States. In fact, I read a report by the Peterson Institute, which said that Buy American provisions protect about 9,000 jobs. Well, that sounds like good news, but actually foreign government procurement of US products supports 650,000 US jobs. So if other governments decide to buy national, that could be really damaging for the United States. And I think, those protectionist instincts, whilst they are quite easy to understand when times are so tough, and particularly with high unemployment, I think it's important to try and combat those so that people, recognise where, the real opportunities, they can, cut the rug out from under their own feet.
Sure, sure. And I understand that. Well, what areas of strength does the UK offer for the Southeast US region?
Well, the Southeast, of course, is a really exciting place for me to be. I think it's got four of the fastest growing states in the nation. And there's lots of really exciting stuff going on. Good logistical links in the Southeast through ports and airports. Strong research. Across the region that I cover, there are, I think, more than 40 Fortune 500 companies. So, some real US heavyweight companies, but also a lot of, entrepreneurial activity. And Atlanta itself, I was reading recently in the Business Chronicle, is topping the charts on entrepreneurship. So, great credit there.
It's interesting. When I came to the States, which is almost 20 years ago, there was a saying, when times are good, people flock to Atlanta. When times are bad, people flock to Atlanta. And very much Atlanta having been at the forefront with the Olympics and so forth in 96, there's been a lot of global expansion in and out of Atlanta. But I think also Atlanta has been able to, albeit we have poor labor statistics that are coming out today, and we've got a very strong, stable base of investment opportunities, and particularly international. I think in the last two decades, that has really expanded strongly.
Now, I think it's very impressive. And of course, there's a strong talent pool here.
And good education.
Yes, absolutely. So for in terms of, what areas of strength the UK has to offer, we see great opportunities here in advanced manufacturing, defence and security, ICT, energy, healthcare and life sciences. These are areas that are strong in both of our countries, and those are areas where we're really focused. We think there are some areas where we're a little bit ahead. For example, in the green economy, on the clean technologies, we've pushed very far and very fast on that. And so, we're very keen to find partnerships in that area. We see that as being a major area of expansion globally. Our companies are growing fast. They've grown all the way through the recession. No breaks went on. And so partnering in that area, we think, is particularly productive.
Well, how does your trade and investment team create more corporate value on both sides of the pond? And I hate to get it down to the numbers, but we're a finance show. So while I don't necessarily ask you to quote chapter and verse of numbers, give us a little bit of a sense of how that corporate value can be expanded.
I think where my trade investment team comes in, it's about helping businesses make the best decision for them. So we don't provide a generic information. We work with individual companies that are trying to assess opportunities in a number of places to make sure they've got the best information available to take a decision on where the UK sits in that choice. And so, you know, we would like to think that we're maximising those opportunities for companies that are looking internationally. And that means providing information on particularly what it's like to do business in the UK, what some of the operational requirements might be. We can help support them on their site selection, on accessing the most advantageous tax and accounting regimes that for their style of business, and anything that they might need to establish business effectively and efficiently.
Well, so Annabel, let's get down to a little bit more of Georgia-specific elements of our conversation. How many British businesses are in the state of Georgia, and how do they impact the Georgia economy?
Well, it's a bit of a moving target because there's still plenty of new business being developed right as we speak between the UK and the US. But there are about 500 British facilities in Georgia, and that includes more than 100 manufacturing locations. And really pleased, the latest assessment I saw was that UK investment in Georgia provides something like 30,000 jobs. And again, those will be the high-value jobs that we spoke about earlier. That's something like 16% of jobs coming from foreign affiliates here in Georgia. Many of the companies here absorbed into the American, you know, company scene. And
in fact, interestingly enough, when I grew up, a lot of what I thought was UK products were actually US products. And having come here, a lot of what I thought were US products are UK products.
Yes, it is interesting. And, some brands are easy to identify, like Rolls-Royce, and they are operating here in Georgia. But others are names of companies that have sprung up, and you really can't tell the difference.
Sure. Well, how are the current economic conditions affecting things? I know that we could perhaps spend a couple of hours on just this one topic alone. The US is still pulling through some of the economic times, and certainly the UK has had a little bit of a sharing, if you will, of the unfortunate times of the economy. But how are things coming for the two countries and that opportunity for foreign investment?
Right. Well, the indicators are actually quite good in the UK. There's the latest surveys by the Confederation of British Industry are showing a boost in, consecutive quarters in terms of business confidence, and other surveys on consumer confidence are also showing rises. So that's good news, including for Georgia, that exports to the UK, we're one of the largest, if not the largest, export destination for Georgia goods. So that's good news. We are back into growth, as the United States is, in terms of percentage GDP, but it is modest growth. Our Q1 growth was just about 0.5% GDP. So, but we've got good news too on employment. Our unemployment is in the last quarter of this year was 7.7%, and that actually fell at its fastest rate since 2000.
So companies are employing again.
They are, and I think bearing in mind where we started on in terms of our austerity measures, it means that private sector job growth is exceeding losses in the public sector. We've got more of that to come, but it gives one a high degree of confidence that things are going in the right direction. And there's also, continuing signs of company activities, crossing the water. And here in Georgia, some of the British companies that are operating are doing very successfully. There's a company I'm visiting next week called JCB, who operate in Savannah. They've added a new production line in April with several hundred new jobs down in that part of Georgia, growing very successfully here in Georgia, but actually accessing a global marketplace from Georgia.
And I know JCB, am I correctly thinking they're big machines and they do digging and they basically move land from one part to another? Is that the JCB?
Yes, that is the JCB with a sort of strong yellow brand cover.
Yes.
And of course, we enjoy investments from some of the big Georgia companies like Coca-Cola, UPS, global payments and so on. There's a lot of continuing activity in their expanding their interests in the UK.
Wonderful. Well, I can't leave the show without asking you about one upcoming topic, the Olympics in London next year. Haven't heard too much hype at this point in terms of media, but this is going to be quite significant. How will this affect what work you're doing and certainly the UK-US trade?
Well, I hope you've noticed I'm wearing my Olympic badge this morning. Yes, we're very delighted to be hosting the Olympics and the Paralympics next year. And we're just about to come up to the 1 year countdown, which is quite exciting. So 27th of July is the countdown to the Olympics. And my team is actually planning a sequence of activities to help celebrate the countdown, you know, sort of key moments of the countdown. But certainly, you know, we see the Games as providing a really big economic impetus, not just to London, but to the whole of the UK. And there's immense commercial opportunity around the Games. And pleased to say that, you know, there are companies here that are accessing those opportunities. One of the companies that I know of that has invested recently in the UK, you know, on the back of the Olympic Games activity is a company called New Fields, which provides environmental services. And so it's a really interesting time to be doing business in the UK.
Wonderful. Well, I'm afraid we're coming towards the end of the show, Annabelle, and we have a standard question that we ask all of our guests. It's a tradition to ask our guests on the show, what is your CFO tip of the month? Going to be a little bit different for you from the perspective of US-UK trade and commerce. What's yours?
Okay. Well, I think my tip is fairly straightforward. I think it would be about thinking global. You know, we are now in such a globalized marketplace. It's a really big mistake to look at one's competitor down the road because the competition is likely to be out of sight in some other country. And for those that are thinking global, I'd really like to encourage them to come and speak to UK Trade and Investment here in Atlanta. Or if you're in another country, there will be a UK Trade and Investment office to talk to find out more about the possibility of business in the UK.
And for those guests that are, for those listeners, that are tuned in today, we will actually put a link on our website on CFO Radio to be able to make that connection. But Annabelle, how do they do that? Is there a website they go to?
Yes, in fact, you can, if you put it into your search engine, UK Trade and Investment, I think it will shoot you straight to the right site. If you're in the United States, you can search for UK in USA, and that will take you to your closest office.
Wonderful. Thank you. Well, thank you very much to Annabelle Malins, our guest today, Consul General in Atlanta for Great Britain, for sharing your innermost thoughts on the role of finance and investment between the UK and the US. And thanks also to our contributor on the news, CFO.com. Thanks finally goes to our sponsors, Delaney Consulting, providing CFOs and controllers to Fortune 1000 companies and small businesses alike. For more information about Delaney, please go to www.delaneyllc.com. And thanks go to our sponsor, Financial Executive International, the preeminent association for CFOs and financial executives. Their website is www.financialexecutives.org. This and other thought leadership from today's CFO is available right from your computer at cforadio.com. If you are a CFO or know of one that would like to be a guest on the show, please contact us via the web. Thanks to listening to CFO Radio. This is Lorraine Chilvers signing off. Until next time.